The passage of time is a map's greatest enemy. Buried under sand, soil and sea are relics of past achievements, including maps that are lost to history. Through the destructive power of history, many ancient maps have become distant dreams, rumours of topography lost in time. Welcome to What's Your Map? An Oculi Mundi Exploration. I'm Jerry Broughton, a map historian. In this series, we speak to people who live, love, and work with maps, making, preserving, interpreting, and being inspired by them. In each episode, we ask our guests to unfold a map that is special to them and tell us the story behind it. To look at the map as we talk about it on this podcast, go to oculi-mundi.com. In today's episode of What's Your Map, we meet Adam Lowe, director of Factum Arte and founder of the Factum Foundation London. Adam heads a groundbreaking conservation company which digitizes and recreates artworks and priceless artifacts, including maps. He's worked with the British Museum, the Louvre, the Prado, and in Egypt's Valley of the Kings, and with various governments worldwide to help preserve artifacts that are at risk of being lost to the ravages of time, war, and simple neglect. Adam, the first question is, what's your map?
So my map is the circular silver map of Mohammed al-Idrisi that was made in 1154 in Palermo in Sicily. It's an amazing object that no longer exists. It was lost, rumoured in a shipwreck, sometime before the end of the 12th century. But we recreated this in Madrid from data that we recorded in the so-called Book of Roger, which is an Ottoman copy made after presumably other copies done from the silver map.
Let's take a closer look at Adam's map. It's made from pure silver, and at 2 meters in diameter, it's one of the biggest and certainly heaviest maps I've ever come across. As Adam has said, it was made in Palermo in Sicily in the 1150s by the Arab mapmaker Mohammed al-Idrisi for the Norman king and ruler of Sicily, Roger II. The sea is shown like scallop shells, carved into the silver. Rivers and mountain ranges crawl over the map's surface like lazy caterpillars. It takes a moment to see that it is oriented with south at the top. So the top half of the map seems empty, a kind of shiny silver blank, but it shows a vast, unknown sub-Saharan Africa, because this was before anyone knew it was possible to sail around the tip of Africa. If your eye finds the map's dead centre, you'll see it is the Arabian Peninsula, and even more precisely, Mecca, the heart of both the map and Idrisi's Islamic religion. Look to the left and you'll see the triangular shape of al-Idrisi's adopted home and Roger II's Norman kingdom of Sicily. It dominates the Mediterranean. Idrisi has magnified it to look 4 times the size of Sardinia, which in reality is only slightly smaller. The story of the silver disc's creation isn't simple. It's shrouded in mystery and destruction. What we know is that King Roger II commissions Idrisi to map the world. Idrisi starts by making a huge silver disc. Then he makes a book of more detailed regional maps, 70 in total, and that book is called the Book of Roger. After Roger and Idrisi die, the silver map is destroyed. It's probably melted down, or another rumour is that it's lost in a shipwreck. And the original Book of Roger is also lost. But later copies of it still survive, including one in the Bodleian Library in Oxford. And it's this copy that people like Adam use to recreate lost maps, like Idrisi's silver disc. Why is south at the top, Adam?
Well, if Mecca's in the centre, you go up to Mecca. and most people live below. So it's a nice conceit in a way. I also have this feeling that they wanted to add more and more data. So they've got this empty bit at the top.
So they could fill it in gradually.
You could keep going. But actually, there's a problem because the east coast of Africa runs horizontally two-thirds of the way up the circular disk, while the west coast of Africa runs sort of vertically up the right-hand side of the disk. So Africa is sort of flayed, if you like. It's sort of splayed out. And there isn't any knowledge beyond the mountains of the moon.
Well, because the classical tradition, the Greeks and the Romans, which of course Idrisi is reading, don't believe that you can get round the tip of South Africa. So what you've got here is the Indian Ocean, as in Idrisi's map, looks like a sort of flooded car park. So Africa goes all the way around to Korea. And that's the inheritance, right? That's what Idrisi thinks because he's read Ptolemy and all the other Greeks. And he synthesized all that information to give us this. But most of the Islamic maps at the time have south at the top. So this is also partly a religious matter because everybody is converting north of Mecca. So they look south. So south is at the top, as in Idrisi's map. That's amazing because he's making it for a Christian ruler.
Probably it wasn't such a clear religious divide at that time. So you have many shared beliefs. There are many things that, especially in Sicily, we're all mulching together. And I wouldn't read too much into the religious implications of South being at the top. But of course, I mean, they're there. Many people will make arguments about that. And I mean, it's the way it is. But I think with Mecca in the center, I mean, Mecca has this real importance on the map. And what I sort of feel is that that unknown area, exactly as you said, is waiting to be filled, but it's based on classical knowledge and it's unknown. And I actually love having a void like that at the top. And if you look at maps now with, well, shrinking, but Antarctica and the Arctic top and bottom, you know, when they're on a rectangular map, they're stretched to infinity. They don't really capture our imagination as these vast masses of ice and water and land. But when you look at a map like this, it does have a sense that as you reorientate, you feel familiar with it. I mean, I've spent too long probably looking at it, so familiarity is one of those things. But I still don't know it. I mean, that's what I love about maps. I mean, you keep going more, you keep going back. You can go back to the same things, but you won't think the same thoughts.
Who is Muhammad al-Idrisi? What do we know about him?
Well, we know he was born in Ceuta in North Africa, that he was educated in Cordoba. He went pretty much to the seat of learning at that time.
Which is Arabic learning at this time, so it's Muslim. So Cordoba, most of Spain is...
It's part of the Umayyad kingdoms in Spain. And Cordoba was very much the centre of learning, I mean, from much earlier. So he went there because of the whole reputation of people like Ibn Firnis or Zayab or others who were, you know, the great thinkers, the great musicians, the great cartographers of the time, or people thinking about the problems of cartography.
And this is really only within the first 300 or 400 years of this incredible expansion of the Islamic Empire, right? So from a point in the 8th century where there's a kind of explosion east and west that suddenly Islam is really the dominant empire, but also culturally and artistically sort of an extraordinary culture that's creating things that Idrisi is working on as well.
Well, I love thinking about Idrisi walking into the mosque in Cordoba, which is, you know, one of the most spectacular buildings with these beautiful sort of red and white arches and the light streaming in. I mean, it's a magical place. Mm. And I think the mosque also articulates some of the complexity that was in Spain at that time. So we've recently been recording around the Mihrab and doing some work in the mosque. And what's emerging is that many of the tesserae used in the mosaics were actually a gift from the Byzantine emperor. So you've actually got Christian emperors giving presents to the Umayyad rulers in Spain. I think this sense of how power works, how it functions, and how we change it or change our perception of it over time. So on one hand, everyone wants to talk about the convivencia now, about the Islamic time in Spain as being all roses. Well, of course, it wasn't. So it's not a simple black or white thing. So I love the idea of Mohammed al-Idrisi being there. And then, you know, getting a call from Roger saying, you've got to come to Sicily and you've got to make a map.
Who is Roger II?
Well, he's a Norman king in Sicily, which is a multicultural place. I mean, the Arab influence there is very, very strong. It's in the heart of the Mediterranean. And Roger manages to hold together a really enlightened kingdom for the whole of his reign. And I think the work that al-Idrisi did with the other cartographers, most of whom appear to have come from North Africa rather than from Europe. So again, I think this flow of knowledge, and I think it's very important that many of the classical texts that you mentioned a while ago were really known through Arabic translations that were done in Damascus, Baghdad, Alexandria, and then filter up to Spain. So Cordoba was the centre of learning.
We've got now this very cosmopolitan Muslim scholar. He leaves Cordoba. He's travelling across the Mediterranean. He's clearly learning, therefore, isn't he, from the classics, you know, from the Greeks, from the Romans, as well as Jewish traditions, and also the Islamic traditions. So this is a cosmopolitan figure. If he's going from somewhere like Cordoba, which is such a great centre of learning in the Arab world, what's Palermo like when he gets there in the mid-12th century? Is that also cosmopolitan, learned? What kind of world is he entering?
Yeah, I think Palermo really is a cosmopolitan hub. I mean, it's right in the heart of the Mediterranean. You've got the trade passing from east to west, more that way round than from west to east, but it goes both ways. And, you know, he's talking to the sailors. He's talking to people who are coming into the harbour. You know, there's reports of, you know, him and his cartographers interviewing everyone feverishly, trying to get a picture of where people have come from, what they've got on their boat, how long it took them, what the wind was like, how much land travel there was, you know, what troubles they encountered, etc., etc. I mean, it's very difficult to imagine a world without an image of itself. And what I think al-Idrisi did, perhaps for the first time, but I always sort of worry about first claims. I mean, I'm sure there were people before him. But actually, he envisages a world which is, with Mecca at the centre, which is not so different from the world we know now. And to pull that out of nowhere. So, you know, much later on, we get Christian cartographers really doing maps of faith and belief and magical animals and one-legged people and people with big earlobes or whatever. So you have all of these figures that inhabit the fringes of the cartographic imagination. So I think al-Idrisi is a trade map. It is very much a map about movement, about flow, about where people go.
Idrisi makes this book, and it's known as the Book of Roger for King Roger II. Tell me about that, because you've looked at that book. What is it? Just describe it for us.
Well, I mean, basically, it's an atlas. So it's divided into double pages with a map that covers the double page, and you turn over and there's the next one. And if you lay them all out together, you can form a rectangular world map.
Because there are how many maps in the book?
Well, I think there's 71 or two or that number.
And so when you were working on scanning those maps, you can then digitally stitch them all together to create a world map that Idrisi didn't really mean to put together, but you get this incredibly detailed image of the world.
Well, I think the relationship between the very famous silver map, which is the map we're really talking about, rather than the Book of Roger, which of course is our point of entry. So Factum Foundation works very, very closely with the Bodleian Library. The Book of Roger's in the Bodleian Library. It's an atlas. It contains 70 maps. They're double pages. They're rectangular. If you piece them all together. So we did a high-resolution scanning of each page. We can then digitally piece these together to form a flat map. Of course, some of the pages don't quite align. It's not like a Times Atlas, where if you cut it up, you can join them all because the scale's all constant. But more or less, they do. So we did some digital correction to make sure the coastlines and the edges of islands align. And you create a rectangular map of the world with South at the top. From the pages of this book.
Now, Idrisi didn't mean to do that, that all the maps are there, so we should just be clear that what you've done and what digital technology can now do is create something that wasn't there originally, but it gives us an insight into what the world looks like for somebody like Idrisi and Roger in the 1150s in Sicily.
I wonder which way round it goes. So, I mean, the question that I always come up with is the map we recorded in the Bodleian is actually an Ottoman copy of earlier maps, which was probably a map made from the silver disk. So the silver disk, I would imagine, is the origin. It's the, if you like, the template from which all other maps were then derived. And the silver disk became incredibly famous, incredibly fast. And you can imagine, suddenly, if you've got the first map of the world, think Google Earth, think anything, this is on that kind of scale. And he's put it together with his team. I mean, they're celebrity cartographers. They're not casual little people working away in rooms unknown. I mean, he's well looked after by Roger. He's very close to the king. The king appears to play a very active part and shows great interest in what he's doing. And I love the idea of all these people engraving the lines into a silver map from drawings that they're putting together in the workshops. And, you know, this is a really craft-based but skillful thing. And getting, I mean, we know the map, the silver map was about 2 meters in diameter. We know the weight of the silver. There's lots of descriptions of it. And it was really the most important work of art on the planet at that time.
Factum then takes all this data from these 70 regional maps by Al-Idrisi, and he leaves us an account of the making of this silver disk. He describes it, he says it's 2 meters in diameter, so that was what you were taking on. Just explain to me the mind-blowing digital process of making this. Not only the digital process, but also then you're making it in pure silver. How did you do that?
With great difficulty is the answer. But actually, within Factum, cartography plays an fundamentally important role. So we work with many different maps and have been looking at many different maps. So Al-Idrisi, for me, was always the Holy Grail. And to use CNC milling machines or marking machines or positioning machines to actually hold an engraving tool to score the lines into the surface of silver was something that I'd wanted to do for years. I mean, we started with very thin silver. And then, of course, it had to get thicker and thicker to get to the level that it would slightly deform under the pressure of the engraving to create a surface that wasn't just scored flat. And especially where the oceans, with the waves, there are places where the engraving tool pushes the silver into little ridges that mimic the lines on the map itself. So for me, making something requires a whole different mindset about how you take data, how you process the data, and then how you present the data. And in this case, we started with sheets of silver that are about 2 foot by 3 foot. Actually mill them in sections because we didn't have big enough machines.
So you mill them with machines. And how long does that take to make the entire disc? How long did it take?
Well, to prepare the data probably took more than a year.
That's capturing the data from the maps digitally.
Once we'd captured it in Oxford, mm-hmm. then we bring it to Madrid and mm-hmm. process it. Then we reproject it onto the circle. Then we correct all the toponyms. Then we talk to you and other experts about the map because we're constantly having to fill in information. I mean, I'm not an academic. I'm not a scholar. I'm a person who makes things. And so here, we're trying to get as much accurate information. I don't want someone to look at it and say, there's a real howler there. That's absolutely not what it should look like. Mm-hmm. You want people to say, wow, this is amazing.
the map is an exemplar of what Factor Marte does. Let's just talk a little bit about that and your story, why you work in this area and Factum. So tell me a bit about what Factum does and how it came about, and also your story, because you were trained as an artist. So tell me a bit about that.
Well, I think objects are profoundly articulate. So I love what we do in Factum. It's always rather difficult in a nutshell to say what we do in Factum, because Factum Arte works with many of the world's leading artists. And I tried to build a workshop, so it's about 60,000 square feet in Madrid, with all the technicians and all the tools that can be like a playground where artists come and they do things they can't do in their studio. What they do alone and single-handedly is one thing, but what you do to turn ideas into physical objects is another. And usually, like in the Renaissance, you need workshops, you need people with different skills, because nobody has all the skills that are needed.
Ah, so this is a bit like Idrisi in Palermo in 1154. You are Idrisi. I mean, what you're describing is what you've told us about Idrisi's world.
Well, I mean, probably there are reasons why I was always interested in Idrisi, and he was one of the figures that, I won't say he was a figure that drew me to Spain, there were others who did that, but he was certainly one that emerged and has grown. And the more cartography plays a part in Factum's life. So digital technology is very, very dependent on mapping. So it's one big change that people still don't fully understand. They think they know what a painting is, what an image is, what a representation is. But actually, it's changed fundamentally over the last 20, 30 years. Mm. You know, now the words that are used in Factum all the time are not familiar to most people. We talk about albedo colour. That's colour with no shadow and no highlight. Flat colour. We talk about normal maps. Normal maps tell you the angle of the polygons on the surface. Without a normal map, you don't have a three-dimensional form. We talk about depth maps. We talk about rendered maps. These are all the language of representation now. And for me, cartography is the vital ingredient in any realist endeavor. So what we're trying to do is build a connection with the world out there through representations of it.
And you trained as an artist. I mean, that is your story, and that's why you're interested in the surface of objects in this way, particularly maps. I mean, you've always been about mapping surfaces. Is that right?
Yeah, I mean, my paintings were always a realist endeavour. I don't mean that people would look at them and say, oh, you know, there's this, that or the other. But they were about how you see. They were about how you mark down what you see, how you respond to the world out there. Because representation forces you to think about the world. I mean, if you're a writer, you're trying to work out how a word creates that image in someone's head. When you're a painter, you're doing the same thing in different ways. When you're a cartographer, you're doing it in the most abstract way, but which is also the most direct. That's the beauty of maps.
What are the other kind of objects that Factum Arte has made, which we would now see as just as lost to history?
We did a whole series on lost paintings. So these were paintings destroyed in the 20th century for one reason or another. So there was a Monet destroyed in a fire at MoMA in 1958. There was the portrait of Winston Churchill by Graham Sutherland that was destroyed on the instruction of Churchill's wife by her lady-in-waiting. There's paintings that were stolen, so like the Vermeer from the Isabella Stewart Gardner collection, that probably still exists. So it's lost, but it may reappear. I mean, my favourite one was the Caravaggio from San Lorenzo, the Oratory of San Lorenzo in Palermo. So bringing us back to Palermo, we were asked to recreate this painting from a little 5-4 colour slide that had been taken in the 60s by a photographer. And we had to recreate a Caravaggio with the qualities of a Caravaggio. Well, this is the kind of project I love, but they're extensive. So the project that we're doing at the moment that is now back in Upper Xingu in Brazil is the sacred cave of Kamakawaka. Is that a map? Not really, but it's covered in petroglyphs which articulate knowledge. So I would say it is a map. It covers a whole wall of this cave overhanging rock. It was very badly vandalized. So most of the petroglyphs had been hacked off. But working with ethnographers and anthropologists and historians, we were able to scan the damaged cave and then to create depth maps to rebuild the missing surface based on photographic evidence. So I think it's using different types of representation to map things in three dimensions. And bathymetric depictions of under the ocean, topographic pictures, images of what's above land. These fascinate me.
So Adam, there must be other mapping projects that are in your mind that you want to fulfil. Give me an example.
I would love to make a three-dimensional map of the world the size of a football pitch with relief from the bottom of the oceans to the top of the mountains, and then start filling it with water so your perception of it changes.
Now, how can you make that on that scale? How does that work? Explain that to me.
Well, you can put a man on the moon, Jerry. You can make a map of the world the size of a football pitch. It's not very difficult.
So how would you make it, Adam? What materials would you use?
I would probably be a bit perverse. I'd probably make it in alabaster so that as you flood it, it starts to decay. So its decay becomes part of its narrative. Normally, humans focus on the things that are most important to them. And right now, the shift is switching to the oceans, because if the oceans aren't protected, we don't have much of a future. So actually, by doing this, you change the relationship between land and water. You change the relationship, or you change the hierarchy of what people think about. And I think, you know, rising sea levels, I think it's now generally accepted there's going to be a rise of at least 45 centimetres by the end of the century. Well, what's that going to do for Venice? So we're constantly looking at places where you have dynamic relationships, and maps normally exclude dynamic things. Mm. They focus on fixed things. They don't tell you the temperature of the ocean because it's moving. They don't show you the clouds because they're moving. They don't show you migration unless that becomes a topic and you try and work out how to map migratory patterns of birds or humans. These are things that you can map, but they're not normally associated with a world map.
Adam Lowe, thank you for joining me on What's Your Map?
It's been a pleasure, Jerry.
Thank you so much for listening. I'm Jerry Broughton. This has been an Oculi Mundi exploration. Oculi Mundi is the online home of the Sunderland collection of antique maps and atlases. The producer is Emily Uchida Finch, and it's a Whistledown production.